Tom Williams, thank you so much for joining me on Talks with Tony today.
Thank you very much for having me, Tony.
An absolute pleasure. And so for people who don't know you, I'm not a fan in a podcast of doing a whole CV, although I've got the whole CV and there's a lot that I want to dip into today. So we're just going to start as we mean to go on. For those people who don't know you, who is the Tom Williams of today?
Well, I guess most people don't know me, but if they do, they probably know me from the winner of the TV survival show Alone, which is on Channel 4 just last year. I'm also, I guess I'm a bit of an adventure guy, adventure bloke. I walk to the North Pole and I run an adventure travel company called Desert Island Survival. So I take people to uninhabited islands and create castaway experiences. So adventure bloke, sort of.
I like that. Tom Williams, adventure bloke. It's like the tagline. if I were to obviously add that into the information, because you just very blasé, oh yeah, you know, trek to the North Pole or won a TV show, and it's a huge thing. And obviously, for those people who don't know, Tom is a self-confessed adventurer. Having, was it 2010 you'd done your North Pole expedition?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 2010, yeah.
However, obviously, a long time since then, you not only entered, but, you know, 2,000 applicants to this TV show alone, you spent, because it was like, yeah, I won this TV show, 35 days alone in the Canadian wilderness, left to your own devices. It's a massive accolade. And obviously, alongside that, won a prize pot and money. So I think we definitely need to delve into all of this. But before we go, I'd love to kind of go back, because many people will see someone like yourself and think, oh, they've always done this kind of thing, you know, must have been born into an adventurous family. It's what they've always done. But, you know, anyone who's done any research on you will identify that you, you know, self-confess, come from quite humble beginnings, you know, and this I relate to, being like the fat kid at school, went massively academic. You know, how does someone who is from such a normal background call the adventure, or was it something that you've always done as a kid? Were you brought up in that kind of a household?
I'm still pinching myself that this is how my life turned out, and it could have so easily gone any other direction. I feel very fortunate that things worked out this way. But no, I grew up in Portsmouth on the south coast of England, and, you know, a nice middle-class family. My mum was very loving and caring. She had her own problems with alcoholism and stuff, and I was an only child. And, you know, there was some darkness there, which didn't do me so well at school. I academically was awful. I came bottom of my school, and talking of bottom, my nickname was actually Bum, not to do with my lack of hard working or grades, but, you know, I was wearing some trousers that you could see my bum one day, and from the age of five, that was my name. I literally moved to South America to shake off that nickname. I was bottom of my school. I think one of my teachers quipped, he said, the only way that Tom Williams will ever get to university is if he climbs through the bathroom window, and then he'll probably get stuck. So, like, I was the fattest kid in my school. I was bottom. I honestly, things were not looking good. You wouldn't have backed this horse for amounting to much. I remember my dad setting me aside one day. Like, he was like, look, Tom, all your friends are much harder working and smarter. They're all going to be leaving Portsmouth. They're all going to be going off to university. You're going to be back here working at McDonald's for the rest of your life unless you kind of buck your ideas up. And that's kind of what you expected for me. Like, it it wasn't looking so good.
How does someone who is effectively, you know, like, they're forms of bullying. You were bullied by children. That's bullying from a teacher. You know, you wouldn't get away with that in today's society. I've got a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old, and it's highly unlikely a teacher would in today's world get away with effectively calling a child fat and saying they wouldn't amount to anything. Your dad, you know, trying to move you forward and use that to G you on, but effectively saying mean things, you'll never amount to anything. Would you say that all of the negativity and all of the, you know, the kind of, all those people who doubt you, would you say that it's in spite of that? Is that what you've used to fuel you to become the person we see today?
And it's not like a conscious effort, but definitely there was, it's given me fuel to want to prove people wrong. And I won't lie, like, to when my school invited me back after walking to the North Pole, you know, after I'd effectively left in disgrace, like, I couldn't continue. All my friends stayed at the school for their A levels and I had to leave because I didn't have good enough grades. And so, yeah, it definitely gave me a bit of impulse and desire to try and prove them wrong. But I don't, you know, I don't know where. I think as a few things have helped me. I'm very optimistic. I'm really, I always see a glass half full, and I always see opportunities instead of, you know, closed doors in front of me. And so I guess that's given me a bit of a kind of, why can't I do that kind of can-do attitude? I think there's a few like massive crossroads I had in life. I think the first one was I scraped into university somehow through clearing. I was at uni and my mate Simon, who was my housemate, he said he was going to Fiji to go and map coral. And I was like, wow. As a huge David Attenborough fan and like huge fan of the marine environment, I was like, that is what I need in my life. I want to be, I love snorkeling and stuff. I want to go and see coral. I've never been to the tropics. And he's like, well, you're not coming with me, mate. This is my project. But this company, Coral Cay Conservation, they've got one going on in Honduras. Why don't you go on that? And so I did. And I went and spent a year of university mapping coral reefs and collecting data on coral and diving twice a day, six times a week, and became a dive master. And I think when I got there, I had zero confidence. I was still, all the labels that I'd been given my whole life were defining me. And then I came back from this with a modicum of self-belief. I was the longest serving on the project. People came to me with questions and I was good at it. And the first time in my life, I found something I was good at and started to get like that little tiny glimmer of self-confidence. And I think from there, things slowly started to improve. And then I found myself, I went and got a proper job. You know, I did the what's expected of all of us, go and get the proper job. And I was in Maidenhead selling software in like some trading estate. And I was just so depressed. I was like, God, what's the point in this? Like, this doesn't fulfill me. There's got to be more to life than this. And then that was when my mate Paul, we're having pints, drowning my sorrows. I was like, yeah, I'm walking to the North Pole. And I was like, yeah, that's what I need. I don't want to be pigeonholed as a software salesman. And so, yeah, so I was like, well, I'll do it, and trained for 2 years and eventually got to the start line, which is a really long journey just to get to the start line in itself. And then, we ended up racing and winning the race. And again, that gave me a new self-belief and confidence. And I guess it's just slowly come from there. So I think for anyone who can relate to, who has those labels currently or lacks self-belief, it's all just a consequence of doing things, leaving your comfort zone, challenging yourself a little bit, and then these things build up your self-belief. And it doesn't happen overnight, but, you know, like 1% better every year, and that kind of compounding effect, it eventually results in really good things. And it can lag as well. Like, it may take 5 years for the good stuff to happen, but it's like, yeah, pushing yourself to just, I don't know, out of your comfort zone, to do things, to, yeah, other good stuff eventually happens. And I guess that's kind of how I feel about it.
You know what, there's absolutely tons in there that I want to unpack, but I think it'd be remiss of me not to focus on the one thing that anyone who is watching this on the episode on YouTube will see, is that you are the smiliest, happiest person, you know, unbelievably humble. The things that you are talking about and the achievements that you've, you know, the accolades and the achievements that you've reached, I think they're second to none, but you talk about them in such a kind of blasé way, whether it be being told that you would never get to university, not being allowed to, you know, stay in the school that you were in for sixth form because your grades weren't good enough, but still not allowing no to be the answer and that to be acceptable, pushed your way through clearing. Despite how you got there, you got to university when you were told you couldn't do it. You went onto the normal route of a job, as many people do, and, you know, having read a lot of information around you and listened back to previous podcasts saying that you were effectively dying inside in this job. It was obviously not that was a good fit for you. Through to, you know, I'm going to go and do this. You're not allowed to come with me, says Simon. No worries, I'll find an alternative way. You become a dive master. This isn't a case of just, you know, I'll give it a go and see what happens. It seems like everything you do, in spite of all of the challenges, the plan is to exceed at it, not just to, you know, from the, oh, I just trained for 2 years. There are so many things in what you've done and achievements that you've made that people wouldn't even dream of doing in a lifetime. And yet you're, outlook on life, despite a challenging upbringing, you know, you mentioned challenges with your mum growing up, and I know from research that, you know, she passed away at a really young age. You were told that you wouldn't amount to anything, and it's like, watch me go. I am forever committed on a phrase where I will say, and the numbers are way skewed, the reality is it's probably more 50-50, but I'm often quoted as saying I'm 99% like pushed forward by it and motivated by a need to succeed, but 1% by spite. It's probably 50-50. It seems you've managed to do that, but with a smile on your face and make friends along the way. I think humility is definitely one of the things you should have up there when you're talking about your accolades. But again, there's just so much to unpack, you know, not only going on this expedition where, as you say, it's really difficult to get to the starting point even of the North Pole expedition, but to win in the Polar Challenge, to not only win, but not be a million miles from a world record. Brilliant. And be, what was the title you were given? Fastest mixed team?
Yeah, right? We were the fastest mixed team. We missed the world record by 2 hours, 2 hours and 20 minutes. We won the race by 2 days.
Let's just put that into context for anyone who doesn't understand it. You won the race by 2 days, by a country mile. So the reality of missing out on the world record might, to many people, 2 hours, 20 minutes sound like they were miles away. You were literally this close. Is that need to succeed something that is innate in you, or has it come from people expecting a lot of you when you were younger, or is it coming from, you know, all my friends were doing it, so I needed to do it? There's got to be something. What's the drive inside of you?
Yeah, I mean, I never had it when I was younger. I was quite happy to just sit there, not concentrating, just to accept that I got terrible grades. I think it came later on with when I got just that modicum of success and was able to show otherwise I wasn't a failure, and that felt good. And maybe that inspired me to then do it again and again and again. And I think my dad is also very hard to impress. And I think there's, you know, all sons want to, you know, want their parents to be proud of them. And it takes an awful lot for him to say he's proud of me. But I think, like, you know, there's been a couple of times winning alone, walking to the North Pole. So I guess, you know, that, it's probably not a great thing to have that, but it definitely pushes you forward to seek approval. But it's not particularly healthy, really, is it?
I mean, it's probably not healthy, but let's be honest, most people don't have a normal upbringing. But the ability for you to use that to fuel you will not let it, you know, if we look at many people and you were to look at two people following the same path, for many people, that would have been the thing that made them spiral down the wrong path, make the wrong choices, you know, kind of two fingers up to, if you believe that of me, then I'm going to prove to you that you're right. No one expects me to achieve anything, so why should I? And I think with you saying you didn't really have that when you were younger, do you think it was just that it didn't really inspire you? It was that, you know, school, academics, the kind of day-to-day just wasn't the fit? Because when you've fallen into the role of adventurer, nobody can challenge the fact that you've massively excelled in it. Do you think, and what I'd love to know in addition to that, was that the thing that fueled you forward when you found your thing? And secondly, does that make you believe that we should be taught in a different way, that there should be opportunities for people to go to, you know, more forest schools, learn more about adventures, lifestyle, etc.?
100%. Yeah, it's that old adage of judging a fish by how well it climbs a tree. And I was at a very traditional school that unless you were good at retaining information and regurgitating it, you were no good to them. It was very academic. And yeah, I'm sure I would have done much, much better in a Montessori or forest school environment for sure. And and it's really, really, really sad that so many people, so many children, and they'll be told that they're rubbish, they're told that they're useless at it just because they're not good at this specific vertical of education that is wanted from them. But and then they'll never really find that, they'll crush their self-belief, and they'll never find their passion or area where they are good at, or even if they do, they maybe don't have the confidence to pursue it because they've already been told they're no good. So 100%, that schooling has a significant part of it. And then I feel immensely privileged to identify a passion, identify something that I am all right at. And, I still refuse to say I'm good at it. I still have a massive imposter syndrome. It's very fortunate. I could talk to you every day, Tony. You're very good at pumping the tires. I feel very, very
Thank
fortunate
you.
To.
But I'm also
have
not
your
the type of person to blow smoke up someone's arse. We, you know, there is a literally TV evidence of you surviving alone in the wilderness. And I think we've got to jump onto that one. I definitely want to discuss the expedition, the Polar Challenge. But the most recent one, obviously, it was aired in 2023. I've got to ask you, though, when was it recorded? How long did you have to keep the secret of you joining?
A year I had to sit on it. So, yeah, we came back in at the end of September 2022, and it came out, what was it? Yeah, like, I can't even remember. Maybe it was May. Yeah, it was about a year later. So that was really hard to keep a secret. They don't send you the money until the last episode airs, just in case you like start flashing the cash.
Still living like a pauper knowing you've got this 100 grand coming your way. Champagne lifestyle on a lemonade budget at that point. This is just huge. So I find that really interesting. That was going to be one of the questions I asked, because way back when, and I don't know if many people who listen to Talks with Tony will know, I was on an episode of The Chase, aired many moons ago. Yeah, believe me, I've not trekked the North Pole. And isn't that interesting? You trek the North Pole, you've lived alone in horrific conditions in Canada in autumn time, which is not very warm, with literally zero provisions. And I go, oh, I went on The Chase once. And you're like, oh, wow, this is what I love about you. You've got this magnetism that just kind of, you've no understanding of how good your achievements are. And I think that's what makes you such a worthy winner, because in terms of alone, like the amount of preparation that you have noted to have done versus what many other, because there was like 2,000 applicants, 11 contestants, there is no doubt that you were the most prepared of those. Is that because you are the type of person to whatever you're doing, you do to the best of your ability? Or was there this innate fear of like, I could be alone for 2-3 months and I need to be prepared? Because some people seem to have taken it, not that I'm taking away from what anybody did, but, you know, you're looking to, you do your research and it's like, oh, they prepared for a few weeks. They did this, they did that. You piled on, was it 3 stone?
Yeah, 3.5 stone in 7 weeks.
I mean, I like my food and I can eat, but yours was intentionally done to prepare you. So what else did you do in preparation for knowing you were going to be, because you didn't know the time frame, did you? No one knows what the outcome is going to be.
Yeah, you don't know how long you're going to be in the wilderness. I had 7 weeks from when I found out I was on the show to when I flew out to Canada. So you don't have an awful amount of time, awfully long amount of time. I mean, I don't do any temperate woodland survival. So I take people to desert islands. I know tropical bushcraft. And I've only been doing that 6 years, which may sound like a long time, but like some of my instructors have been doing it 15, 20 years. I still feel pretty new to this. I had to like trade in my machete for an axe and start learning as quick as possible about the flora and fauna in temperate woodlands, because it's all obviously completely different. I memorized the kind of shelter. I didn't practice a shelter. I just memorized exactly what I would do and drew it out kind of step by step. I just thought about like how my strategy is. I go into this. I'm a huge fan of the show. I've been watching this for like 10 years. So it was a dream come true to get to do it. I just wrote out kind of my plan, my notes, and got really fat. And I honestly felt so disgusting. Like, I can't. It's fun at first, but I mean, straight away, I'd start with olive oil, which is horrific. It's like peppery on the back of the throat.
Pure olive oil.
Yeah. So I switched quickly to coconut oil, and I put it in a smoothie with like protein shakes and stuff. And just 300 mL is 2,500 calories. So if anyone wants to get as fat as possible, not many people are into it, but it's all about the coconut oil. And then I'd have coffee with double cream and sugar, which tastes like Bailey's. It's amazing. Nice. And then just the like carbs. Yeah, when the acid reflux kicks in like I just started to feel pretty foul, but kept on going, pushed on getting fat as possible. And honestly, I got to the train. So we go out there, you meet the others for 10 days. We go through like what to do if you get attacked by a bear and different medical strategies and how to use these cameras. Cause they're like, here are the cameras. We spent 2 million quid on a show. Please come back with some footage. And I met all the others. And like, honestly, I felt like all of them knew more than me. I thought at least half of them were way more skilled than I was. And I was learning from them as well. So honestly, I didn't go into it in any way thinking, yeah, I'm the cream of the crop, I've got this. Yeah. And not just from a kind of humility perspective, I really didn't feel like there's no way that I was like thinking I'm easily going to win this. I was absolutely shocked when I found out there's only four people left after 30 days. And so to win it, and when I won it as well, like it does sound a bit more arrogant, but I was genuinely disappointed. I honestly wanted to, it's such a long, obviously I quite seem to be into self-growth and stuff now these days. And like, it's such a long journey to get to the edge of my comfort zone. And outside of that is this uncharted territory where so much development can happen, where I can learn more about myself and I can kind of build up my tolerance and to adversity. And I really wanted to push past that and kind of learn and grow as a person. And I also really wanted to see this place like transformed into a winter wonderland. I love snow. Yeah. And I never when it finished, I had 20 fillets of fish stashed away that I was, so I had like 20 days of food. The show doesn't show that at all.
So this is the kind of the information that I wanted to get to, because there may be people who, you know, when they've seen the program, they know what you do. You own your own company. You are the founder of Desert Island Survival. There will undoubtedly have been people who thought, well, Tom's got it sussed because, you know, he runs this company where you effectively maroon people on an island and they have to survive. But you've already touched upon the fact that they are completely different circumstances. Then, because you're such an avid fan of that, because it's an American TV program alone by Origin, and you know the average time frame there is like 2 months, 3 months that people are in the wilderness. So the reason, because I feel like it needs context for anyone who's not aware of the TV program and hears you go, yeah, I was quite disappointed when I won. Is that based on the fact that you'd expected so much more? You prepared yourself, despite it being a short time frame of only 7 weeks, but you'd prepared yourself for this real hardship. Because, you know, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, you had 20 days worth of fish. You'd, you know, found peppermint to be able to make mint to make your own peppermint tea. You have a smile on your face the entire time through, like quite happy, you know, happy as Larry. I'm just living this chilled lifestyle in a different environment. Is that the reason for you feeling disappointed, because you feel like you've got untapped resources and you didn't quite meet the challenges you expected?
Yeah, the shortest the American show has ever gone is 65 days. So I was preparing mentally to be out there for 65 days. And so, you know, I was ticking off the days, and in my mind, I'd got to halfway. And you spend a long time kind of steeling your brain for this is your mission. You will be here for this lot. So it was very jarring to come out of that. It didn't really explain, but for anyone who doesn't know the show, you genuinely are alone. You get dropped off out of a helicopter in the middle of the Canadian wilderness. So like 1,000 miles in every direction is just forest. And it's so quiet. And you get to take 10 items with you, you know, like an axe and a saw and a sleeping bag and a cooking pot. And you just got to film yourself. You've got to, you know, you've got to get a shelter, water, fire, food. You've got to survive. So that solitude is quite intense. And, you know, you've got no one to lean on but yourself. So one of the other reasons I was kind of remiss, like for it to end when it did, is that I started to feel so happy that because I had money in the bank, food, you know, calories and the money of nature, you know, ancestrally, this is all that mattered. It's just about eating and reproducing, you know, we're animals. And I was living this very simple lifestyle where all I had to do was find my food. And the brain really gets off on this. When you strip away all of this like cheap dopamine from our phones and stimulation that we get on a day-to-day basis, and you live this very, almost like a monk, kind of a nature monk existence. And you're outside all the time. You know, you're watching this squirrel family over here and kind of, you know, that's your entertainment. And fishing is this huge dopamine rush that you get when it's like going to the casino when you fish, like every little bite is so exciting and exhilarating. And you're getting loads of, you know, sunlight, and you're moving your body all the time. You know, you're not stuck behind a desk. It's what we did for 99% of our evolved existence. We were hunter gatherers, and it's only now we live kind of born into the captivity of civilization, and so it feels so good. It feels so good to live this way. And I'm quite a happy guy, but I hit new levels of happiness, like beyond I knew was possible. And the diet plays a huge role as well. Like just eating this super clean diet of leaves and fish, There are things like I've learned quite a lot since, but there's a thing like a fungus called Candida that we all have in us that lives off sugar. And when you don't have, it dies away when you don't have sugars and starches. Yeah. And you feel so much better without this one. I used to have irritable bowel syndrome for like the last 15 years, IBS, and that went away and it hasn't come back 2 years later because I think my gut biome had this total reset through spending 35 days of simple diet and everything was able to find equilibrium again. Honestly, I'm thinking of setting up a new company as well called the Primal Reset, where people can get their gut biome checked, they can get their blood levels done, they can do an epigenetic test and find out their kind of age from their makeup, then go into an experience like this with some preparation as well, and then have a test afterwards, and like a month-long experience to allow people to fully reset. I honestly I didn't realize the impact would be so significant. And I'll just finish my rant by saying I'm probably writing a book on this called You Are an Animal. I am writing a book. It's just really hard to write a book. And in my research, I was amazed to see like if you, I think of us as effectively being in zoos of modern civilization. And I thought about primates in the same situation. And I can't believe I'd learned that like 70% of primates in zoos are on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medicine. I had no idea that that was the case. And it kind of makes sense that we're somewhat the same, you know, we think of it as so normal, but we're so far removed from what is our biological normal. And we haven't evolved a second since like 70,000 years ago.
Do you know what? It's fascinating. And again, like there's so much to unpack in that the way that you speak and the enthusiasm you have about this whole scenario, and also the two fingers up to every teacher at school who told you you weren't capable. You know, this is what I'm a massive believer in. You know, I'm a huge entrepreneur. I've got young children. I'm teaching them, you know, pick whatever you want at school, because the reality is, unless you're going to be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, it's actually not really relevant to everyday life. And yes, it's you're looking at it from the outdoors adventure side. I'm looking at it from the entrepreneurial side. But I think there's a lot that people can take away from that, because one of the big reasons I host this podcast is that we've all got, you know, irrespective of what's happened in our lives, every one of us have got things that we can share. So I think it is showcasing to those children or those adults who feel like they're a square peg in a round hole, you know, doing the day-to-day, the 9-to-5 in a job that they hate going to because that's what society expects. But how fascinating it is. That's just shocking that, you know, we keep these animals in captivity. And I've never really thought of it in that context of that's exactly where we are. Now, I'll be honest with you. The idea of being on a desert island or being marooned somewhere, you know, in the Canadian wilderness, I love my own company to a certain point, but I think I would go insane because I am such a to be around people. You know, you can tell that you're really excited when you're talking about the flora and the fauna and the excitement of this, whereas I'm like that when I'm surrounded by other people. So I think I'd enjoy it to a point, but that'd be a massive mental challenge for me. For you, it seems like, you know, you were actually disappointed because you were prepared for so much more solitude. Like, how did you keep yourself occupied? Yes, there is but there's only so many times you can watch the squirrel family. Was it that you were all new things, or was it that you have always been, because you're an only child as well, did that play it? I'm one of six. Does that play its part?
I think it does. I'm definitely an introvert, even though I'm quite happy being extroverted. Yeah. It's not a permanent state that my energy levels go down. And so I definitely am an introvert, and that play into it. I think the camera is like, it's like my Wilson, you know, the volleyball in Castaway. It was like an agony aunt, and it was actually really good company to be able to just constantly be chatting away to this camera. It gave you a bit of purpose. I think doing it in a void in a genuine situation without that would be much harder. But fishing was like my big outlet. I like fishing anyway. And there's obviously huge productive use of your time. And I'd fish every day for 4 hours at least. And like I said, it was like going to the casino. You realize what the dopamine system in your brain is made for. Like, this is a reward system to encourage you to keep on foraging, keep on finding food, keep on striving. And it would, you know, every cast would be like, oh, am I going to get one? And then you catch it on the bottom of the riverbed and you're like, oh, was that one? And you feel this because you're living this base level existence and there's no other kind of stimuli, you really notice these highs. And then when you do catch one, the euphoria is amazing. And then the eating it as well is like nothing else. On day 25, they didn't show this. I put my net out. I caught zero fish the whole time. But one day I went and checked it and there was a duck, dead duck in there. And I love duck on a normal day. But when you haven't eaten anything but fish and leaves for 25 days and you eat a roast duck, I roasted this lovely bird in my pan with coals on the top, like cooked it for 4 hours, heat from all different directions, and it like properly rendered. It was insane. I opened the lid, the smell was intoxicating. I think I wept in my pan. And honestly, like, it was the most stupidly tasty thing I've ever tasted in my life. Like, the aperture of your senses opens up so much when you're out there. You hear more, you smell more, you taste more, you see more. But yeah, taste, when you haven't had like salts and minerals that your body needs that for 25 days, and then you have this, the pleasure centers go through the roof. It will forever be better than any triple Michelin star experience in the world, because hunger is the best source. And it was just amazing. And they didn't use that.
Didn't show that. Well, I wonder if it was because they were fearful that even though your sole purpose was to forage and stay alive, there'd be, you know, Ofcom complaints that someone's roasted a duck.
Eva, one of the girls, caught a duck, but hers was a more interesting narrative because she was a vegetarian who had to kill a duck. And so that was more interesting. And they, you know, I caught like 36 fish. They showed me catch two. They had to kind of throw viewers off the scent that I had this, you know, that I had a decent amount of food out there, because it needed to be a close race for the story. It's a shame, but it's, you know, it's TV. But apart from that, nothing else is contrived. Like, it is in the bushcraft community, we call it the Survival Olympics, because there's Naked and Afraid and all these ones where they literally give you food. They make you squabble. But this was, you know, it is as authentic as it gets, but they still choose the edit.
Yeah. And do you think that, like, has that created a new appreciation in you? You know, did that remain with you because duck was this, you know, completely unexpected? It was like eating a Michelin star meal. Have you retained that level of, because the excitement, it's like, oh my word, you know, your senses were all heightened, etc. Do you still feel that level? Because obviously there's a complete difference because you've moved back into normality. So I suppose the questions are, do you still have that level of appreciation now that you've integrated for, you know, over a year into the, 2 years into the normal world? And how hard was it going from, you know, hearing every sound to being in complete solitude? You know, was that quite a hard transition back to normal life?
Yeah, so I definitely have held on to some extra appreciation, but it's impossible to hold on to that level of appreciation that I got, like, with that duck. But, like, next, when I was at a hotel recently and there's that breakfast spread of all these things, like, my mind pops with just this abundance of calories that we have available to us and how different reality is in the modern world. But I do try to have that little bit more gratitude for food. It's probably only a few percent of what I had for that duck, but it's still that little bit more. And when we have people come on the desert island trip, they come back and they call it a gratitude reset, because, you know, you come back and you're like, isn't running water and taps amazing? Aren't flat surfaces so brilliant? And, you know, I just love having no sand. And so it's really nice to go. We've had Russian billionaires come on our trip who have not felt anything from their super yachts anymore. And then they come and do this and they really reappreciate. That's obviously a real one-off, but it's really good to have that shift. And we're doing a higher end experience called Luxury Accentuated, where you come out and you go to like really nice 5-star hotel that feels like a 10-star hotel when you get off the island. Because just like me with that duck, if you starve yourself and then have it, you really feel it so much more. And I think there's a lot to be said then. But going back to your second question, so when they picked me up and I went back to the hotel, God, it was weird. Like, the aperture of senses are all really open, and then people are talking to you and it's overstimulating. And I couldn't talk to people for more than like 10 minutes before getting really tired. And that night I tried to go to sleep in the hotel, and every single noise in the hotel was waking me up. Like, my senses were so acute, because you're still thinking like any rustle is a bear or whatever. So it took me till 3 in the morning. It was like I was on amphetamines. I was lying there just like buzzing. And I had to like open the windows and have like the white noise of outside, and it took me forever. Yeah, it was really weird. And that went away after a few days, but it makes you realize, like, again, we have all these senses, we just don't use them, and we can't have them turned up loud because, you know, city life would be so overwhelming for us, but, you know, they're all there.
So has this, because obviously you run Desert Island Survival, you've now got all of these new ideas, the book is going to be created, you know, the Primal Reset retreat is going to be created off the back of it. Was that always an intention? Because as well as being an adventurer and a motivational speaker, you are an entrepreneur. Was that at the back of the mind, or was it purely I offer this as a service to people where they can come and be marooned on a desert island, but I've never really done that in real life? You know, what was more the drive, or was there a conscious decision? Because an entrepreneur is always an entrepreneur, you know, I want to promote the business. This is something that I know can help people. So was it to fuel the business, or was it purely, I want to prove that I can do it, and that'll be, you know, a nice byproduct?
Going on alone?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I did it purely for the, obviously I wanted any kind of spin-off publicity for Desert Island Survival. Yeah. But no, I did it for the adventure. As I said, I watched this for 10 years and always dreamt, like, how would I do? I actually built up for a year, of knowing I'd won, my expectations were quite high. I thought, maybe I'm going to be on TV again, and maybe I'm going to get like 50,000 followers on Instagram, and this is all going to be really good for finding business for Desert Island Survival. And none of it happened. I think they didn't make a particularly compelling story of me. My character arc wasn't great, and they didn't mention Desert Island Survival. They said Tom, travel director. We haven't seen any. There's no uptick in bookings, and I thought, you know, I thought it'd be really good for my profile. I'm hopefully doing a TEDx later this year, talking about you are an animal and these kind of concepts, and maybe a bit of motivational stuff. But I did think a few things would come easier from it, but no.
Shocked by that, if I'm honest, especially when you look at it in terms of, because, you know, I am an entrepreneur, I do host a podcast, and I'm hoping, you know, well, I know that there are byproducts off the back of it. I'm very fortunate that I host a podcast just because I like interviewing interesting people. And the reality is, when you're starting a podcast, or even, you know, it takes a while to monetize, it takes a while to build up an audience, etc. So I do it for the love of it. But if something so big, you know, it was on a Channel 4, so it's on a big channel, I'm really shocked that there wasn't a more of a promotion of it or an uptake in regards to it, especially when you compare that with a lot of kind of reality TV programs. And you look at the likes of a Love Island, where they live in luxury in this, you know, villa, and there's a lot of manipulation, there's a lot of, you know, things that are planned, and they come out with millions of followers. Is there a little bit of you, because you are like the happiest person ever, is there a little bit of you that thinks, I'm a little bit pissed off by that?
I was definitely disappointed. I definitely felt disappointed, I won't lie. Like, I did think, maybe I'll be recognized. I haven't been recognized once in the street. Not that that really matters, but like, I did think having a social following is really useful, obviously, for business. Yeah. And I added 400 followers on Instagram, and yeah, I did think something would happen. So there was a real readjustment of expectations versus reality. But, you know, it is what it is. And hopefully I'll have to achieve it through something else, be it a book or speaking.
Well, I don't know. The book is speaking, get on more podcasts, but also get a loan picked up, because it's huge in America. Get a loan picked up by Netflix or Prime or something.
It's already aired in America as well, and Australia. I think, you know, had there been two of us going neck and neck, maybe for the last, like, pushing to 50-60 days, had there been a more dramatic story, it would have been different. Mm-hmm. But it just turned out, it wasn't the most compelling season, sadly.
Anyone
who's interested in the show should watch season 6 and 7 of the American show. Like, honestly, it's vintage. You should as well, Tony, if you haven't seen it.
I feel like I'm missing out.
It's amazing. Season 6 and 7.
I'm fascinated by it, simply because when you think about what you actually did endure, I know by your standards, because you prepared yourself for 2, maybe 3 months of being in the wilderness, you know, you piled on and then you lost all of the weight and more. There is that to be said, you know, your preparation is definitely what put you leaps and bounds ahead of the competition and probably why it ended so prematurely in comparison to the American kind of version of it. But there's been so many byproducts off the back, irrespective of the fact that it hasn't done what you were hoping necessarily in the business. Cured IBS, ideas coming off the back of it in terms of, you know, more business, TED Talks, motivational speaker, etc. So what's next? Because has this made you want to move the business forward in a different way? Do you plan to do more wilderness expeditions? I suppose that's twofold. What's next for you, Tom, in general? And what's next for the business side of it, the island survival side of it?
Yeah, so, I mean, don't get me wrong. Going on alone, honestly, was the best experience of my life, and I won $100,000. I'm very grateful for the whole experience. So just to clarify that, honestly, it was a life-affirming. Nah, it was honestly the best experience of my life, and it taught me so much. I just wanted more, but that's just greedy. Anyway, so what is, I mean, so Desert Island Survival has been going now for 7 years. We run expeditions to uninhabited islands in the Philippines, Panama, and Tonga in South Pacific. But finding desert islands is really hard, and I'm very picky about these uninhabited islands. Like just finding an island, you've got to, I look on Google Earth forever, and you're trying to find places that are close enough to tourism that you can, at least people can get in without like 2 days of travel, that you've got a hotel before and after, that we've got a medical clinic in case of evac. So we've got to have an evacuation strategy. Then it's got to be a beautiful island, and it's got to have sufficient resources for us to run enough trips. And then it's got to not have certain dangers like pit vipers and pirates. And then you can't have like swarms of insects. And then it's got to be affordable. Like there's plenty of islands that just people won't rent, because why would I want to rent it to this small company? And so like it's extremely hard to find islands and to scale as a business. It's a beautiful lifestyle business. I adore it, and I love what we do. Today we've got people in Panama hearing from the instructors having the most amazing affirming experience of their life, and it's gorgeous. And when people send me messages about how it's changed their perspective on life, it's the most valuable thing. But there's only so much we can grow this island survival. So yeah, I'm looking up setting, and I'm building it right now. I still haven't even settled on the domain, but we've written most of the website, which is going to be basically different wilderness adventures in different environments. So we're doing some stuff up in Lapland. I'm going to Sweden tomorrow to Rekia destination. We're going to be doing some survival at minus 15. So I'm finally going to get my winter. And then we're doing stuff with the Matis tribes in the Amazon. We're doing some stuff up in Northern Canada. We're doing, a experience in Botswana on the Okavango Delta. So it's like a safari kayak. So instead of being in a car, you kayak for 5 days and then you survive on an island in the middle of this flooded delta the size of the UK. So building out like all these kind of dream similar experiences. So on our islands, you do 5 days of training where we ease people into this whole new environment. Like most people have never, ever been done any bushcraft before. Some people have never been camping. We want it to be accessible to anyone who just has an interest in this stuff. Like you, Tony, that's why you're coming next year. And and then... And then so it's 5 days of like survival light. They're sleeping in expedition hammocks. We've built a mosquito nets, and we're feeding them really well whilst they're learning how to make fire by friction, you know, rubbing sticks together, and how to build traps, how to identify wild edibles, how to weave palms, make rope from natural fibers, like all sorts of cool bushcraft stuff. And, you know, we pass around a bottle of rum in the evening. Everyone like really bonds beautifully, like the vulnerability that hams out in this environment, and people connect. It's gorgeous, like 5 days. And then after 5 days, just as everyone's getting a bit too comfortable, we kick them out of the nest and they go for 3 days to a new part of the island with just a machete, handful of fish hooks and sat phone and a medikit. And they have to survive and put into practice their new skills. So we are taking that kind of concept and putting it in different environments, different wildernesses.
It's honestly fascinating. And I think I'm either your ideal client or your nemesis, because I've never been camping. I like my luxuries. When I go on holiday, I want a 5-star hotel. I'm like, I don't know whether I'd be your biggest nemesis or a challenge accepted will make you enjoy it. I don't think I'm very handy with anything. You know, I have a husband who does anything remotely. Like he was that child who was in the cadets and he loved, you know, I can use a gun and I love fishing and I love this. And I'm like, I can use a phone and ring who I need help from.
I'm really good with Uber Eats.
I'm like, well, I've fasted for a little while. I've done some intermittent fasting. I can last a little while without food, you know, not to the level that you've done previously. So yeah, now that you've said it on here, we kind of want to do it, but I'm also scared.
I would say, like, just like alone, just like all these situations, they're a 50% mental, 50% physical challenge. And I can tell straight away you've got a perfect mindset for this kind of stuff. I bet you love learning. I bet you do. Like, you're positive, you're optimistic, and I think you'd like learning and self-betterment. So I reckon you'd thrive.
No, Tom, that's because I'm sat in a warm, comfortable house with all of my luxuries around me, you know, and water is literally in bottles in the fridge. And I think I'd be good to a certain extent. And I think my husband would definitely attest to this, that I'm awful in a, like, I've always been mum. I've always been the one who organises things. But if he's there or somebody else is there, I'd be like, oh, I'll just leave you to that because that's yours. I think I'd probably handle things quite well if I was the only one there. But yeah, it sounds like both something really exciting, but also my idea of hell. I talk myself out of running while I'm running. I have a verbal conversation in my head going, you're really tired, you know, you probably should stop soon. So it's probably something I should definitely do.
When you do it then. No, not at all. When you do it, we'll have you do the solo survival. So your husband can't like take over.
No, maybe not.
Point, can I interject on that? Because like, that's one of the things we talk about in psychology of survival and mindset. Like when I train for the North Pole, our instructor, our personal trainer, he said that you should approach every exercise like you're hanging onto a branch. And if you were to let go and fall, then certain death would await you. You wouldn't just kind of let go. You would hold on until like every last muscle was screaming in your arms and your fingers slipped and eventually, you know, you fell. And it's like, that's how you need to approach every run, every weight lift, everything. And so, and I later learned, so when we went and did the North Pole twice, I failed. So when we want to give up, we're normally giving up mentally, not physically. Yeah. You know, our body can continue more, but we go, oh, it hurts. I can't do it. I don't want to do it. I don't want to endure the pain. And so twice when we were walking to the North Pole, I fell asleep and just fell into the snow. And it's the only time that I've actually physically truly given up rather than mentally giving up. And endurance athletes call this, they call it the rule of, fell asleep straight into the snow, like just collapsed and didn't, it was like I blacked out. And my other teammates did it as well. We really pushed ourselves. So endurance athletes call this the rule of 40%. Like when you want to stop and you feel that need to stop, that's you at 40% of your capacity. It's just your preservation, your brain saying, okay, please stop it now. And so when you're running, just think about like, no, that's just a message from my brain. I can put another step forward, another step, another step. And just keep raising that number a little bit and like, just be mindful of it.
Do you know what? I always talk about perspective in a lot of the things that I do. I teach public speaking, I teach property investment. We talk about perspective. But I think you're literally living and breathing it there because, you know, of a morning when you get, even this morning, I'm in a conversation, I was like, oh, I'm tired this morning. I don't know tiredness after, you know, 8 hours of sleep in a lovely, comfortable bed, not literally falling asleep upright on an expedition in the snow. I definitely find you strange for wanting and craving the winter and the snow. Like, there is, because, you know, you've got a family now, you've got a little boy, you know, is that I want him to come along and do these things? Or is it that, you know, I've got to lead the way? Because you mentioned if we go all of the way back to the start of the podcast when you were talking about, you know, your dad being quite tough on you and saying you'll never amount to anything, you know, all your friends are going to leave you behind, which he'd probably use to fuel you. Is everything that you're doing to showcase to your little boy that this is what's possible? Or is it, you know, it's just me anyway and you can take it or leave it? I'm fascinated by that dynamic.
It's definitely take it or leave it. I'm absolutely nothing about me as a pushy dad and like, you have to do this. He'll find his own way. Our parenting style is just shower him in love. Just know that he's always, you know, we've always got his back and he's always looked after. I think that fosters, that nurtures his self-confidence and self-belief. Just like, he just feels very very looked after and stable. But I always gently encourage him to push his limits, to go a little bit, try and explain things for him to go a little bit past his comfort zone, just incrementally, like be it climbing a tree or different games that we're playing and stuff. And just building resilience. And it's interesting, I was going to say what you were saying there about perspective. And so like when I did the North Bowl, we live our day-to-day lives. Our comfort zone is maybe here, you know, this little kind of bubble that we push to the edge of. And we live these day-to-day oscillations at the edge of our comfort zone back in. And then when you do something so stupid as what's at the North Pole, you go all the way out here, you blow the balloon up all the way out, and then you come back in. And then you back into these day-to-day oscillations. But the challenge at that last kind of perimeter of your resilience is now nothing compared to what you did at the North Pole. Yeah. And so it's much easier to deal with these day-to-day challenges. So like, you know, the next time you have an 8-hour delay in an airport, you're just like, brilliant. Shelter, water, fire, food. I've got Subway over there. I've got my laptop with all my shows on. I can lie on the ground there. That's way more comfortable than this. And it shifts that perspective of what is real challenge and what is real adversity. And I think it really helps to reframe stuff. And again, I'll not rant too much more, but one of the things I looked at is historical framing. So you can read about our past ancestors and what they've endured, like all the really dark stuff, if you want to get to the very edge of darkness, things like Auschwitz, and then the Gulag Chronicles in Russia, and realizing, you know, like people 20 to a cell lying in feces, covered in mites, you know, just abhorrent survival. And then I was thinking about this when I was in my shelter and alone, you know, I've got this big comfy sleeping bag and I've got no reason to complain. This, a mouse just ran across my face. But relative to that, and I think I caught him and I ate him. I think, yeah.
You literally ate a mouse who ran across your face.
Yeah. I built a mouse trap.
Was that a high or a low of the trip? I can't quite get my head around it.
I was a little disappointed that I overcooked him. I should have boiled him, but a mouse is disappointingly non, like it's the same as two olives. It's about 40 calories, but it was still, it was a nice change. It was the first red meat I'd had in a while. I was just happy to have him.
Your ability to reframe things and use it to fuel you, I think, as much as we're laughing and joking about this, challenges in childhood, you know, we touched upon your mum passed away, something that I relate to. My mum passed away when she was 64, I was 21. And a lot of people would let that break them. You use that to fuel you and make you realise your own mortality and kind of go, there's something more out there. There has got to be, do you think this is a nature thing? Because you mentioned you had this challenging upbringing, whether it be school, living in a challenging conditions, because you've mentioned that your mum had, you know, her own addiction problems, mentioned in how dad kind of pushed you, but not necessarily in the most supportive of ways. Do you think it's something that is innate inside of you that has made you move forward? Because many people would have broken under that. And, you know, they would have been the people who also fall into addiction or who believe what is being said to them. You know, I'm a big believer in the way that we raise not just our own children, but everyone around us, as an employer, as a family member, the way that you speak to people, the things that you say, people listen, we start to believe them. You hear it often enough that you're stupid or that you're incapable or whatever, you start to believe it. So how did you, because I always want there to be lessons for those listening, how does someone who's faced real challenging situations before you've put yourself voluntarily into challenging situations, was it something that's innate inside of you? Is it something you've had to nurture? Is it a focus on mindset? Like what made you who you are?
I think it's definitely a hybrid of nature and nurture. I'm sure that my nature is I'm very fortunate that I'm a happy, optimistic guy by default. I'm very fortunate with this. I feel like my serotonin tap is just that little bit left dripping on more than most people. And that's, you know, a slight brain chemistry tweak that helps me out there. So that really helps me to know, never like overanalyze things, to always think, well, I'll definitely try that because it'll probably work out it will work out well for me. Whereas so many people will, with a negative lens, won't try things because they've already played it out in their mind. What's the point in trying? So there's definitely some nature there. And then nurture, like, I think, yeah, I use the analogy of adversity. I think I've had just the right amount of adversity without trauma. So like you could, there's this dome in Texas in 1992 called the Biosphere Project, where they had these trees, like the Eden Project, just like the Eden Project. They had these trees inside this dome. After 5 years, these trees fell over. And they're like, why are the trees falling over? And they fell over because they had no wind. And trees need wind to put out their roots into these broad systems. They need wind to put out their to make their bark a certain kind of strengthening process. And I think we're the same. We need a good bit of adversity just to, you know, to build up that resilience and that tolerance. And, you know, I wrestled with addiction when I was younger as well. I smoked weed from age 13 till 20 until I went to Honduras. Every day I waked and baked, ate every single day. You know, I binge drink from age 13 and till basically 35. And plenty of other drugs as well. Like, and there, you know, there's a lot of addiction and numbing that's gone into it. But then I don't know, just come out at the other side. I don't know. I feel very fortunate that things have worked out for me. There's a million different alternative realities where they didn't. And I think I've just had enough. I don't know. I've just managed to pull up from many situations in time, and I've been definitely a dollop of luck along the way. But I also don't believe too much in luck. I do believe in probability. I think we make opportunities through probability. And again, I look at that on the survival side. Like, if you set one trap and you catch a rabbit, that was lucky. If you set 100 traps and you catch one rabbit, then that's more probability. And we make our own luck. The more that we see opportunities and we take them, you know, maybe we only get 1 in 10 of those opportunities that comes to fruition, but you have to constantly be,
in the way of the opportunity. You're putting yourself in the way of catching a fish by, you know, laying more traps to catch your animals, more nets to catch your fish. But
I'll share another story as well. I was in Panama like in 2009, and I was on a scuba dive and I saw this amazing super yacht and I took a photo of it. And then I came back to dreary Clapham and I was like, oh, I need adventure. I need to escape. And I went for my photos and I saw this yacht and I Googled the name of it, Timonier. And then I found a website and I sent them an email saying, hi, my name's Tom. I'm walking to the North Pole next year. I want to get into the super yacht industry. Do I need contacts? Do I need experience, et cetera, et cetera? They replied and they said, hey, Tom, good to hear from you. We're actually based in Lymington in south of England. Let's go for coffee. And I met the manager of the super yacht and he told me about the industry. And he's like, you know what? I like you. Let's give you a chance on the yacht. So they flew me to Vancouver and I joined this super yacht, all because I sent an email. And we sailed it to San Francisco for a month. Then we spent a month there. Then we sailed it to the Galapagos Islands. Then we sailed it to Easter Island. And they dropped me back off in Chile, where I lived for 9 years. And only because I sent an email, and you know, it costs nothing to send an email. It's just an exponential return. You can't lose anything, but you can gain so much. And just daring to believe and dream and email people that inspire you and say, hey, would you mind, could I do some work with you or something like that? It never hurts to ask. And so again, having that kind of optimism that things might work out, sometimes they do, it's mad.
Do you know what it is? It's absolutely mad. But in reality, how many people think about doing these things? I wish I'd like to. And I think as much as definitely we all have a little bit of luck on our side. But I think you need to give yourself credit for what you've actually done. Never did I have. Obviously, I do my research before I speak to any of my guests on the podcast, but I wasn't aware that you'd gone through addiction at such a young age, that you'd fallen, because we talked earlier on, you could very easily have gone down, you know, which fork in the road do you go down? There are many people who've taken the same fork as you have and not been able to come out the other side of it. And I think one of the traits that you downplay more than anything is your humility. You've achieved phenomenal things. You shouldn't necessarily have been able to achieve the things that you have, given the upbringing that you had and the decisions that you made from really young ages. And I think I always like people to hear the lessons. And there may be someone right now who is listening to this, who is maybe at the fork in the road, or maybe they've taken, you know, one of the routes already and think, oh, it's, you know, there's no coming back from this. And I think that you're proof that is possible. You have ridiculous amounts of humility, a massive, amazing mindset, but also a phenomenal story that I think more people need to hear, which is why I am so grateful that you have shared everything that you've shared. And I feel like we've barely scratched the surface. I feel like there's still a ton more that we could discuss. I am conscious of your time, though. And one of the key things that I always ask my guests is, what is the one question that you wish people would ask? Or what is the one subject matter that nobody ever touches upon that you think is really important to discuss? Multiple. And I know I'm throwing you under a bus there by giving you that with zero preparation, but it's done purposely so that it's the first thing that comes to mind.
Well, it's really just a continuation of what we were saying. It's risk. I think ancestrally, we have mechanisms to stop us from taking risks. We lived in small tribes. You know, if you upset someone in your small tribe or whatever, like, or you ask someone out, you see them for, and they say no, you see them for the rest of your life, and it has strong impacts. This software, our brain, is outdated, and it doesn't really represent the modern world that we live in, and we're very, very risk averse generally as a species. And I think too many people are too scared to make changes in their life. They always, you know, say they answer the questions for themselves of why they shouldn't leave that job, they shouldn't move country, they shouldn't do this. They always choose the risk averse path. And I think it's really important to take more gambles, particularly if you are younger in life, when you have less to lose and more to gain. People don't be afraid to take risks, because typically you're going to learn a lot from it. And even if you go back to square one, you're never truly back to square one, because you've gained so much from that journey. It's like setting up a business. You know, most people, their fifth business is the one that makes it, or whatever it may be, but they learned so much through those four failures or whatever it was before. Yeah. So I think risk-taking is exceptionally important. Again, it helps to be really optimistic, but you've got to take more risks in life. Otherwise, you know, if you just play it safe all the way, it's unlikely that it's going to be exceptional. If you just stay in the safe middle of the bell curve, that's not where exceptional existences occur. You've got to be at the edge of the bell curve.
What a fabulous way to finish the podcast. So if anyone wants to hear more about your upcoming book, they want to hear more about your stories with your motivational speeches, they want to be, you know, a part of Desert Island Survival, what is the best way for people to hunt you down?
Well, if they do Instagram, I'm Tom Williams Alone. My website is tomwilliams.tv, and I'm going to be putting out some more news on there. I've been a bit quiet, but like the new business and such will be there. And if they're interested in joining us on a desert island, they should go to desertislandsurvival.com.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for your time, Tom. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining me on Talks.
I've loved it, Tony. Can we talk every week?
Absolutely. you're great. I've got a feeling you'll talk me into things that I really don't want to do, but should do.
You're coming to the island. I'll see you there.